Hello and welcome to Playback. Fiona Kelly here, standing in for Marion Richardson.
But I have to say frankly to Deputy Martin that whatever political disagreements I may have had with him or with the Fianna Fáil party over the years, I think many of the former statesmen in his party would be appalled by the cavalier attitude he has taken to An Garda Síochána, against whom he has made the most serious allegations without waiting to establish the truth or otherwise of them.
That was the Minister for Justice, Alan Shatter, as heard in the Dáil on Wednesday during a 35-minute speech relating to the GSOC controversy and the dossier supplied to his office last week by Micheál Martin. One of the people the Minister mentioned in the course of that speech was Mary Lynch, the taxi driver who was attacked by Gerry McGrath, who was out on bail at the time of the attack and who was also out on bail when he later killed Sylvia Roach Kelly. On Wednesday's drive time, Mary Lynch gave her reaction to Minister Shatter's speech to Fergal Keane.
He said how he sympathised with me. I didn't need sympathy and still don't need sympathy. What I need is, number one, an apology for what has happened and an explanation as to why it happened.
He said something specifically about your case this morning, that he regretted that you weren't informed that your court case was on.
Yes, he said that he regretted that I wasn't informed about my court case, but that I was informed about my court case. I knew my court case was coming up on the 7th of January. My problem was that on the 5th of January, I got a phone call from the guard to say there was no need for me to go to court, that my case was not going ahead. And the next phone call I got was on the 7th in the afternoon to tell me that my man got 9 months.
And your man at this stage was a notorious murderer?
At this stage was a notorious murderer, yes.
So by not getting you to go to court, what was the effect of that?
I was very upset. I was very annoyed because all along I had said that I wanted to be in the court. I wanted to be able to face this man in a safe environment. And they had told me that if I wanted to, I could give a victim impact statement, which I didn't know until the day whether I was going to or not. But none of that, I got to do none of it. You know, I don't know how my case was presented in the court. I don't know what evidence was provided to the judge in the court. And also the photographs of my injuries, the bite on my shoulder, my black eye and the bruises on my neck. I don't know whether they were shown in court. You see, that's my problem. I don't know what happened in the court that day.
Mary Lynch talking to Fergal Keane on Wednesday's Drive Time. On Thursday's Morning Ireland, retired Garda Detective Inspector Gerry O'Carroll spoke to Gavin Jennings about the negative impact the whole controversy has had on the Gardaí. He also spoke about the personal toll which it has taken on whistleblower Sergeant Maurice McCabe.
Maurice McCabe is a wronged man. And
Wronged by who, Gerry O'Carroll?
Wronged, I just say wronged by the politicians, wrong by his own authorities, wrong by the Garda Commissioner. This man has gone out on a limb. He has committed career suicide. It is an extraordinary thing. This has gone on for 7 years, this man. He has made, and I use the word allegations, and that's what they stand at the moment, serious allegations. Some of them, in relation to the penalty points, have been vindicated by no less a personage and an authority than the Comptroller and Auditor General. The commission set up by the inquiry set up by Garda Commissioner said that the O'Mahony was a disaster. It was never going to work. I've said this on your programme. It was guards investigating guards. Nobody believes that anymore. Maurice McCabe is a wrong man. He has been described by no less of Micheál Martin, by Pat Rabbit of Labour, by senators, by colleagues, by TDs, as a man of honour and integrity, who's fighting, seems to be like King Canute, fighting against a tide and getting nowhere, and being called then disgusting by the Garda Commissioner in front of the whole nation. How does his family feel? How his colleagues feel? Will anybody blow the whistle again?
Retired Garda Detective Inspector Gerry O'Carroll, as heard on Thursday's Morning Ireland. Another Dáil speech which attracted a lot of attention this week was the one made by independent TD Mick Wallace in response to Minister Shatter's speech on Wednesday.
Minister, if you are going to stay in power and the Commissioner is going to stay in place, then I think this Parliament is a sham. The people are right to be cynical about politics. They're right to be cynical about politicians. This place is a joke. We play games in here. Well, you know what? Sometimes these games lead to the unfair distribution of justice or no justice being distributed. Sometimes these games
lead to people losing their lives. They lead to murders. They lead to the families not getting any justice.
1 minute remaining.
And what do we see so often when such bad things raise their head? We see our police force circle the wagons. We see our politicians circle the wagons. Do what it takes to cover up what we don't want to see. Do what it takes to hide the truth. Is there any appetite for doing things any different in this House? Minister, you look up here at us and you say, how dare those people with their long hair and raggy jeans have the audacity to challenge you? Well, I want to tell you something. The people of Wexford that elected me to come in here didn't elect me to come in here and approve of your behaviour. They came in here, they put me in here to challenge us.
Thank you, David.
It's time for you to go, Minister, and bring the Commissioner with you.
That was Mick Wallace's speech in the Dáil on Wednesday, and this is Oliver Callan's take on aspects of that speech as heard on last night's Callan's Kicks.
Back off now.
Easy.
I'll just chance putting the shovel on next.
Careful.
Easy does it there now.
You're not normally so anxious to get your hands on a shovel, Jerry.
Buckaroo! For goodness sake.
This was level 3. Level 3, Leo. Jeez, I got the hang of this already. What? Super Mario, eat your freaking heart out.
Would you keep it down over there, Taoiseach? What do I do now, little Mickey? Do I keep tapping the screen? Do I like it?
You have to throw the angry board at that thing over there, Mick. That's it. That's a good one now. Connect Four! I've done it! Connect Four!
Deputy Wallace, yeah!
Listen, Count Carla, this place is a joke. We play games in here.
The two fat ladies, bingo!
Well, you know what? Sometimes those games lead to an unfair distribution of justice.
Red again, the House wins.
Sometimes they lead to people losing their lives.
Ah, fick it, Leo. How many lives have I left now?
You're down to just two, Taoiseach.
I wish that long-haired fella in the raggy jeans would just keep it down a bit. I can't concentrate on rescuing Princess Peach.
30 seconds remaining, Deputy Wallace. We see our politicians circle the wagons. We see our police force circle the wagons.
Wagons!
Do what it takes to hide the truth. Cover up what we don't want to see.
Was it Mrs. Peacock with the dagger in the drawing room?
It's time for you to go, Minister, and bring the Commissioner with you.
Well done, Deputy Wallace.
Thanks, sir.
The highest word score there was, let me see, well, it was 28.
Oh, brilliant.
For getting the X in Wexford on a double letter score.
Lovely.
So well done, you.
I'd never beat you in it, though, Alan. You're the best.
Of course, I'm more of a blood sports man myself, Mick.
Host for pints. Donkey Kong champion.
From last night's Callan's Kicks.
The last few weeks have taken a huge toll on the wider rehab group, our clients, staff and their families. We've wondered what we've done wrong. We don't recognise the picture of the rehab group that's been painted in recent weeks. My total remuneration has been published and the rehab group has committed to publishing the total remuneration of senior management team.
That was Angela Cairns, the Chief Executive of Rehab, as heard during her contribution to Thursday's 7-hour hearing of the Public Accounts Committee. Sinn Féin's Mary Lou MacDonald, a member of that committee, spoke to Mary Wilson on Drive Time afterwards about how there is more to come from her committee's perspective.
We have been given a commitment by Rehab that they will furnish us with the report that Ms. Cairns referenced several times in terms of the benchmarking of her salary, a benchmarking report which incidentally suggests that rather than being overpaid, that she is underpaid by some 20%. We have a commitment that we will get information in respect of the cost or value of the pension pot of the outgoing chief executive. And we have commitments in terms of other issues that were raised around different organisations. But just to say this, I have no doubt that all of these controversies have taken their toll on public confidence and on service users and staff and their families. But Mary, I've had substantial contact from people who work within rehab And let me tell you, they are very clear in their view that the organisation has to be open. And they're also okay. clear that not so long ago, Ms Kearns and her senior management team were before the Labour Relations Commission arguing the toss and insisting that the ordinary workers were public sector workers and had to take a cut in their pay. Meanwhile, they protected their own incomes and their own very, very generous salaries.
Mary Lou MacDonald on Thursday's Drive Time. By the time the late debate went on air on Thursday night, following the seven-hour hearing and an appearance on primetime, independent TD and panellist Shane Ross was sounding uncharacteristically tired. Audrey Carville asked him about the charitable status of rehab.
Is it time to rethink the charitable status afforded to a group like rehab? Because clearly, given what she said today, people are asking, how is this a charity?
Well, that's right. I mean, they're wearing two hats at the same time when it's convenient and playing ducks and drakes with various companies as well. And what they, you know, they get charitable status and yet they say, you know, as 60% of their business is done commercially, they're entitled to some sort of commercial secrecy. And that's quite clever and quite convenient. But if you take away their charitable status, of course, it may have awful complications and implications for the people who benefit from it. I mean, we tended to forget today. Well, I certainly did, and it's my fault. I mean, you tend to forget today the fantastic work they do. Hmm. And that's something which we mustn't forget, and we mustn't destroy that or harm that in any way in what we're doing. And there's no doubt that their funding will go down as a result of the what's been happening. I think it's important that the kind of shock to the charity industry and the shock to rehab and to the CRC, which are all basically wonderful organisations, is short and sharp. But what we're fighting for is a transparency which will have a long-term good, and there may be a short-term harm. So I don't think really I would withdraw the charitable status because of the good work they do, but I would certainly keep pushing on for transparency. And it's quite apparent from what we saw today that we'll have to do something further to increase that transparency. There was an absolute militant opposition and obstruction of further transparency. And basically what they were saying to us was, we don't have to tell you, so we're not going to tell you, and we're not going to tell anybody else. That really isn't acceptable, so we'll have to push it further.
Shane Ross talking to Audrey Carville on Thursday's Late Debate. The situation in Ukraine was another story which continued to receive a lot of airtime this week. Your editor Tony Connolly fed into a number of programmes throughout the week, as well as keeping us up to date on his Twitter feed as he travelled between Ukraine and Crimea. On Friday's Morning Ireland, Tony reported on the latest development in that story.
I'm actually talking to you from Kiev Airport, and I have just flown from Simferopol Airport, that's the airport where those armed troops appeared. Now, I arrived at the airport at 5:30 local time this morning, and there were a number of armed troops wearing olive fatigues, and these looked like professional troops. They were certainly not paramilitary troops. They were about six to eight in number, but they were accompanied by a number of paramilitary officers who were wearing distinctive ribbons, which we'd seen yesterday in Sevastopol. Now, these would be pro-Russian irregular or paramilitary figures. I took a couple of photographs of the troops and then was challenged by one of the paramilitary officers who stood next to me, insisting I delete the pictures. I did get one picture, which I posted on Twitter. But it was unclear who these men were. There were no insignia. But it appears now from reports that more of these armed troops have arrived and are at the airport in Simferopol. We had no problem actually leaving and checking in for the flight to Kiev and leaving. But there are reports now that the airport is in some way under the control of these troops.
RTÉ's Europe editor Tony Connolly, as heard on Friday's Morning Ireland. Earlier in the week on Today with Sean O'Rourke, Edward Lucas of The Economist magazine gave his perspective on the situation in Ukraine.
think we should certainly be saying to the Ukrainian government that they need to reassure the Russian-speaking East and South that it's got a role and a voice in Ukraine's future. And I think that, broadly speaking, they are willing to do that. The men with the money in Ukrainian politics do actually come from the East and are basically Russian speakers. So the assuming, which I'm afraid I do, that the Ukrainian politics continues to be run by these oligarchs and tycoons, I don't think the East of the country is going to find its interests neglected. I think we can do more through international organizations to maybe stabilize the situation in Crimea and offer international human rights monitors and things like that. But ultimately, none of this is going to... If Russia is bent on stirring the pot and making things worse, they have plenty of ability to do so. They can wage economic warfare against Ukraine by cutting off the gas and imposing trade sanctions. They can stage provocations pretty much anywhere in the country. And they can whip up separatists, particularly in Crimea, and they've got a large naval base. So in the end, if they want to play hardball, they can.
And what about the fact then that we're having we're going to have new elections, former campaigning starting really today, I suppose you could say. The former Premier Yulia Tymoshenko is considered, according to some observers, the favourite to win, but maybe there's a case, according to other people, for completely new figures to emerge.
Oh, I strongly agree with the idea we need new figures. I know most of the big players in the Ukrainian elite, and I wouldn't trust them to run my daughter's birthday party, let alone a country of 40 million people. And I think particularly Mrs. Tymoshenko has really had a deplorable record in office. She's been Prime Minister, she's been Energy Minister, and I think she's shown herself unable to work with other people, to be very confrontational, very dramatic, great orator, lots of populism, but it doesn't actually bring the reforms that Ukraine has been needing for 25 years. So I think it would be very good to have some new people. But, of course, new politicians can't be grown like potatoes. They don't just come over. You know, it's difficult to magic them into existence. And I do worry. And I think we have an extremely weak political elite, a mixture of people with very corrupt ties to the old regime and, on the other hand, some novices and some extremists, facing these three colossal problems of recasting the political system, saving the economy from default, and dealing with the geopolitical tug of war. And any of those problems would be enough for a well-run country, but for probably the worst-run country in Europe, they're really daunting indeed.
Edward Lucas of The Economist, as heard on Tuesdays Today with Sean O'Rourke. There's a lot of talk on air this week about the increasing number of people who are becoming homeless in Dublin. On Wednesday, mother of three, Gwen Connell, staged a protest outside the Department of Social Protection. She and her family are living in three different locations since a recent rent increase drove them out of their family home in West Dublin. She spoke to Drive Time reporter Brian Lally.
We were living in Ongar in Dublin 15. We had a rent increase of €400 just before Christmas. We couldn't meet that rent increase, so we were given a termination for a 56 days notice. Unfortunately, I am on rent allowance. There's no landlords accepting rent allowance. And that's my whole issue. I have references, and I'm a good tenant. We've never had any problems. You know, I don't think everyone should be tarnished with the same brush. And it's not fair, you know. We just want to be able to live together. Just be happy, really.
She had just done my bedroom up as a Christmas present, and then a few weeks later we found out we had to leave, so it was like a waste of money nearly and waste of time.
I never wanted myself or the girls being labelled homeless, and I didn't want to bring them down the homeless route, because even the homeless section doesn't even know where they're going to put you. And with Lauren, she needs to be studying. She needs, you know, she comes home from school, she spends her time doing her homework, and it's bed. That's like Monday to Friday, and that's what it is, isn't it? Like, she works hard at school, and so do the other two as well. They need stability, I suppose, and we've had that up until before Christmas, and now it's just all over the place. Although they're with family and they're with friends, they're not with their mom. I'm their mom. I'm supposed to protect them and look after them and do the small things, you know, and kiss them goodnight, be there when they wake up in the morning. That's what we're used to. Like, I'm staying in my friend's house. Lauren is staying with my mum, and Katie and Lana are staying with her dad.
I just want to be living with my mum and the girls again, and that's all. Just to be living somewhere so we can be happy.
Gwen and Lauren Connell talking to Brian Lally on Wednesday's Drive Time. Also on Drive Time on Tuesday, we heard about the retirement of jockey Johnny Murta, who told Robbie Irwin about how he now has his sights firmly set on becoming a full-time trainer.
It's a full-on job being a trainer. 45 horses, a lot of new owners. You know, I wouldn't have been able to give it, you know, both my full attention. So I've had a brilliant as a jockey, and I want to give the training 100% and all my energy into that side of it. So I think the owners, the horses, my staff, they all deserve Johnny Murtagh, the trainer, now. It's the right decision, and I'm very happy with it. Racing's been very good to me. I was 15 before I rode my first horse. I went to race. From race, I got sent out to John Ox's. And from there, I was just living the dream. I've been living the dream ever since.
Jockey turned trainer Johnny Murtagh, as heard on Tuesday's Drive Time. Another sportsman who was wearing a different hat on air this week was rugby player Neil Francis, who you might remember got into a bit of hot water recently over comments he made about gay people in sport. Well, the Mooney Show recruited him to review a new production of Swan Lake, which opened in Dublin this week. And at the end of the show, Brenda Donoghue asked him what he's learned from the whole experience.
I said it on radio last week, and I apologise because I did offend certain sectors of the community. And I was in a situation where, I realised that, and I had to make an apology. So it was something that I was never going to win in terms of trying to even explain myself. And I thought some of the reaction was fairly vitriolic and unfair. I know from this moment on, exactly what I can and can't say. I strained out of my domain, and I won't be doing that again. I'll stick to what I'm good at.
Did you say sorry to your wife, Rachel? Because she was very annoyed. Rachel, did he apologise to you?
He did, and my boys, who were very annoyed as well. They were very unimpressed with him.
But do you think you have to self-censor yourself now, Neil?
No, last time I checked, I lived in a democracy. I place a huge emphasis on free speech and the ability to articulate any opinion that you have. But we've moved forward, I suppose, in the last sort of 10, sort of 15 years. It has become very PC. And I must say, over the last week or so, I've had, about 300 texts and messages of support from people to say, look, you got yourself into a little predicament there, and we don't envy you the situation you're in. You did the right thing. We'll know
in
the future.
Apologising or in...
Yeah, I sort of to apologise. So, I realised that's what I had to do, and that's what I did.
Neil Francis has heard on Wednesday's Mooney. Someone else who had an unpleasant brush with the media this week was RTÉ newsreader Sharon Violon. Following a court case which involved a stalker, three tabloid newspapers carried pictures of Sharon out walking in her civvies last weekend. She spoke to Joe Duffy on Monday's Liveline about the unwelcome invasion of her privacy.
I mean, the whole irony, Joe, about this is, this harassment business that's been going on since Christmas hasn't knocked, a feather out of me. And I've handled it really, really well. Yeah. And I look upon it as a bit of an occupational hazard, and I've just got on with things, and I think I've been fairly robust about it all. And I can honestly say, perverse and all as this sounds, that I was probably more upset this morning seeing those photographs than I have been at any stage over the last 6 weeks, and that's the truth.
And were you aware that there was a photographer following you on Saturday and Sunday?
No, absolutely not. It was a very covert operation. And I honestly didn't notice anybody hanging around in bushes. And I mean, this was clearly long lens stuff. And I'm disgusted, to be perfectly honest.
One paper described it as your bizarre outfit. Another paper, in their editorial, The Mirror said you'd look like a dog's dinner.
Yeah, and I did. And you know what? I mean, I don't set myself up as a supermodel. Yeah. I'm a working journalist. I scrub up well, and I do look like a dog's dinner. And that's my right. It's my right to throw on my slouchy pants and my UGG boots and a battered old cardigan when I'm bringing my little one to school. And it's my right to scrub up when I want to. I don't live my life thinking that there are paparazzi on my street waiting to get a shot of me. I mean, this isn't the Kardashians, for goodness sake. I'm a very regular Joe Soap. I happen to be on the news every night, but my lifestyle is very, very ordinary, Joe. Really, really very ordinary.
It will be said, Sharon, your photograph sells newspapers.
Yeah, they get a sneaky photograph from some low-life paparazzi guy and they put it on their front page. It's disgusting. That shakes me. That stirs me more than any deranged stalker.
Sharon Violon talking to Joe Duffy on Monday's Liveline. Fiona Kelly here, standing in for Marion Richardson. Journalist Katrina Palmer has written recently about her 14-year relationship she's had with her birth mother, who gave her up for adoption in the early 1970s. Katrina was John Murray's guest on Tuesday, and at this point in the interview, she told John how she feels about the secretive nature of the relationship she now has with her mother.
She got married, she built this life, and she never spoke about me ever again.
So the fact of your existence isn't known to her family?
No, it's not. I am, you know, her darkest secret, and our relationship as a result is secret. I mean, in the article I wrote last week, I said that the relationship feels clandestine, that it's almost like an affair. And that's really the best analogy I can use. You know, 14 years in, we meet when obviously I come home to Dublin, which is usually once or twice a year.
So she makes an excuse about where she's going?
Yeah, yeah. And I don't ask her. I don't ask her what her excuses are. I've never asked her that. I just assume that she has some excuse to leave the house. The relationship has evolved over the years. You know, initially we would meet in just one particular hotel in Dublin, and it was a place where we both felt comfortable. Now, 14 years down the line, we've sort of branched out a little bit. We're braver. We've taken our affair onto the road, so to speak. So we meet in other places. We have one place that we prefer in Dublin. We go for walks, which is unusual. We haven't, you know, done that. She's met my children. So it's much more open amongst the two of us, but it's still completely and utterly a secret.
And presumably it can only be a few hours, because she would have to explain away why she was absent from the family home for a night or a day.
Absolutely, yeah. No, we've never spent a night together. We've never gone away. It's usually about two and a half hours. And I will see her several times when I'm home. It's usually during the day. You know, my parents know what I'm doing, where I'm going. Obviously, her family doesn't. I used to bring her gifts when I first met her. You know, it was almost like a love affair. And I think that's another thing about reuniting with your birth parents. There is this element at the beginning that's so exciting. It's just so thrilling to have this new person in your life. And you're, you know, literally falling in love with this person all over again. So I used to bring her gifts. You know, I would stop at duty free on the way home from wherever it was I was living. I would buy her perfume. I would stop, you know, on Grafton Street and get a huge bunch of flowers. And then I realised that, hang on, you know, I'm complicating her life here. How does she explain
these gifts,
this extravagance at home? So I stopped, you know.
I
would bring her flowers every day if I could.
Katrina Palmer talking to John Murray on Tuesday. Cormac McInallan was the captain of Tyrone's All-Ireland winning football team when he died in his sleep at the age of 24, 10 years ago next week. His parents, Bridget and Brendan, were in studio with Sean O'Rourke on Thursday. And Bridget described how she and her son, Donal, made the tragic discovery.
It was early in the morning and totally unexpected. Donal heard noise coming from his room, which he thought was coughing or choking or something, snoring maybe. And he went to check, you know, because it was unusual, especially as loud as it was. And when he discovered, he just knew by Cormac that there was something seriously wrong, and he came to get us. He called me, and I went to look at Cormac, and he was just lying very peacefully with his arms out over the blankets, but his eyes were half open, and by that I knew everything wasn't right. So I started to try to waken him, and felt his pulse, and then tried different things. And Brendan came along, and he said, "You know, I think he's dead," and it was an absolutely shocking time. And I suppose what we just did is went through what we had to go through and tried to call doctors, ambulances as quickly as possible, and also called a friend who was a doctor. But, you know, getting him out of his bed in the middle of the night, 3 o'clock in the morning. And then Brendan had to go to meet the ambulance. And in the meantime, just after, you know, after checking on Cormac, it's a question of somebody trying CPR and somebody else calling numbers. But like most people, just can't do CPR just, you know, off the cuff, although I had a little bit of experience years before. But and as well as that, we probably would have needed a defibrillator, which, of course, we'd never even heard of.
Bridget McInallan remembering her son Cormac, who died 10 years ago next week, from Thursday's Today Show. Meteorologist Evelyn Cusack was Derek Mooney's guest in studio on Tuesday. Amongst other things, she spoke about, well, yes, the weather.
Why does the report go all Irish coastal waters and the Irish Sea? Is the Irish Sea an Irish coastal area, as Martine and Galway?
We cover the Irish Sea. Irish coastal waters goes out about 30, 35 kilometres. So if you go out from the east coast 35 kilometres, there's still a bit left over. So we're allowed to cover the rest of the Irish Sea. But the British Met Office has jurisdiction, if you like, to provide forecasts for, you know, you've heard of Fastnet, Lundy, yes. Shannon, Rockall. So they cover all that. So we just get to cover our own little area and the Irish Sea. Because a lot of our boats go across, you know, Dublin, Liverpool.
I love the sea area forecast.
Do you like it?
Oh, yeah, but yeah. Something about it. You know, yeah, it sounds cold.
I like it when it's high pressure sits over Ireland, winds for all sea areas, variable force 3 or less with local sea breezes. That's what we want.
Do you know what I've said?
I like the names of the places.
Yeah. Malinhead.
Malinhead, yeah, go on.
Mizenhead.
Oh, people get very excited.
The one at the moment, listening to this. The one I actually don't use, I hate, is Bloody Foreland. Sounds a bit, you know, it does bloody, sound a bit odd, yeah. Doesn't it? Katrina might know about it.
Why is it called Bloody Foreland?
I don't know, do you?
Something must have happened. Somebody,
yeah. Evelyn said to me she'd like to get Ireland and just pull it down a little bit, didn't you?
A few degrees. Yeah. I mean, I love Ireland, obviously. But if we could tow it down maybe 3 or 4 degrees south,
it wouldn't
just
suit
a little
us.
Bit.
It would.
It wouldn't.
It would. It would.
You know, Madeira, not quite as far south as Madeira, but sort of halfway between Ireland and Madeira. To me, that's the ideal climate. But I remember reading a meteorologist years ago said if there was a big hall like the RDS and at all stands, you put all the climates of the world, say Chile, Peru, Australia, and described all the climates of the world, and then you let people go and choose. Most people would actually choose Ireland's climate.
Yeah, I prefer it.
Yeah, because, well, apart from our climate is quite benign at most of the time, geologically Ireland's in a very good spot too. We don't get
hurricanes, we don't get tornadoes. Like, if we got them, we'd know all about
we
it.
We would know all
severe
about
droughts.
It, yeah. Severe droughts.
There's a lot to be said for
where
we live.
There's a lot to be said. Now, it is a bit too wet. So, as I said, if we could pull us down just a few degrees south.
Maybe 1 degree.
Well, the south of England is a lot warmer than Ireland.
Yeah,
but it is more to the east as well.
Well, OK, down a bit, right
over
a bit.
It. Down a bit, left a bit.
Evelyn Cusack in the company of Derek Mooney and Brenda Donoghue on Tuesday's Mooney. Last Saturday's Countrywide featured a nice report from the Castle Island Mart in County Kerry, where Damien O'Reilly met up with some local members of the farming community.
And how long have you been farming?
All my life. All my life.
And you enjoy it though, do you?
I love it. I love it. I love being out with the cattle, but I hate the house.
Really?
I love getting out.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love calf and cows.
She has bullocks for sale.
Oh,
here.
You have bullocks for sale?
I have bullocks for sale today.
And you're hoping to get a good price?
I'm hoping to get a right good price.
Do you say a few prayers beforehand?
Well, I say loads of prayers at night and curses as well.
Who do you pray to?
Oh, I pray to everyone I can think of. But a curse is good.
A curse is just as good.
I'm cursed to be at the bend.
Right, and do you have a figure now in your head how much you want?
I want about £1,000 for him.
Not today, darling.
Not today, yes. Well, 900 anyway.
Right, or you'll bring them home, would you?
I will not bring them home and then share with the other ones.
Right. 2 year olds.
300.
Richard, we're here with another man. Who's this?
Sean O'Keefe, Guineaguilla.
Sean, how are you? Are you retired or are you still?
I'm kind of semi-retired now.
Right.
I'm gone in the dry stock now.
Okay.
But I produced milk back in the 60s, 70s and 80s. I'm 82. I'm very interested in football. I carry a 136 All Ireland and I lay them out for you now. 1903, 4, 19, 13, 14, 24, 26, 29, 30, 31, 32, 37, 39, 40, 41, 46, 53, 55, 59, 62, 69, 70, 75, 78, 79, 80, 81, 84, captain by Ambrose Gentleman, 85, 6, 97, 2000, 4, 6, 7, 9.
You're a mighty man.
From last Saturday's Countrywide with Damien O'Reilly. Maisie was a caller to Liveline on Tuesday. Hers was a story of deception, fraud and a broken heart. She told Joe about how she was taken in by a man who convinced her that he was due a payout from the Institutional Abuse Fund. She met him through an online dating site and was due to marry him when she realised that he wasn't all he seemed.
Yes, he was due to marry me.
And you had agreed, you had said yes.
Yes, because I thought he was such a sweet person. Okay. And I really thought, oh my God, he's so hard done by and he's had such a very sad life and my heart went out to him. I thought he was sweet and kind and lovely.
So you're within, you're within a week of marrying this man. And
yes, within a week. And what, he told me that he had everything booked. I wasn't to lift a finger. He had everything done. He had gone to the bridal shop and bought my dress and he had flowers, a band, he had everything done. And the engagement ring was coming. It was a massive diamond, the value of €15,000. Bought, ordered, handmade. It was going to be exquisite. And I thought, oh my God, above in heaven, this man is just too good to be true. This is not happening to me. And I was right. It wasn't happening to me. He was too good to be true. He's a pathological liar. He actually physically brought me into a garage to buy me a new car. And he told the garage man, I'll be back for that on Tuesday. And he got me to test drive it. And he, in the nicest possible way, convinced me to sell my car. He told me it was a 07 car. It was too old. I needed a proper car. And he was going to buy this car for me. And it was to be a Mercedes, and I deserved to drive a Mercedes.
And this was all
going to... He had me on a pedestal. I felt like I was the queen.
By the way, did you sell your car?
Yes, I did sell my car. And yes, I did give him my savings, unknown, and he's promised me he would give them back to me. And he was so... His face, his eyes, he was so convincing, and I believed him. And I am such an idiot.
How did you rumble him, Maisie?
How I found out he was so bad was actually one occasion he happened to leave his phone down. Mm-hmm. His phone was like part of his body. He never left it away from him physically. On one occasion he did. And I was very bold and I had a look.
Okay.
And I was blown away. He was on porn sites on his phone, on the internet, and he was using the internet in my house to go on these sites, which was shocking for me because I've got a little two-year-old grandson. I don't even want him in the same county as that man. He had so many phone numbers in his phone and they were all under just one name, like Mary, Bridget, Alice, Anna, whatever.
Okay.
You know, all,
just Christian
just
names,
one
yeah.
name.
Yeah.
So I got very suspicious and very fast I was able to write down phone numbers and I contacted the ladies who own these phone numbers and I spoke to them about this person and they said yes, he had told them all the very same things he had told me.
Maisie, a caller to Tuesday's Liveline. The very funny comedian Maeve Higgins was John Murray's guest on the line from her new home in New York on Thursday.
You had difficulty though, I believe, one night getting into one of your own gigs.
Oh, I did, because I was doing this show in Webster Hall, which is like a big, beautiful theatre in the village. And I was playing in a smaller room, like as part of this gig called The Talent Show, which is like this really good kind of cabaret night. They have like these two old ladies who play the spoons and sing wartime songs. And I was on, and Ira Glass was on, who's one of my favourite radio presenters. So I was doing a gig with all these cool people. And then I couldn't get in because here you need your ID everywhere you go. And they have like a New York ID card, but I don't have one of those yet because I have to get the paperwork and stuff. So I have to bring my passport and I don't really like doing that. Anyway, I didn't have any ID. And I was at the door and I said to the bouncer, I was like, oh, I'm actually on the show, but I don't have ID. And there was a big line and there was a lot of, it was kind of like pushing and shoving at the door. And I was like, this is amazing for a cabaret night. Then the bouncer was like, oh, I know what you're doing. I know your gig. I get it. I get it. And I was like, what? And it turned out that Codeline were playing, you know, the Irish band.
Yes.
And they were playing Webster Hall the same night and it was sold out. And so he recognized my accent and he was convinced that I was just trying to blag my way into the show. And
a young now, Irish girl, a groupie. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And like, now I'm sure that they're brilliant, but I actually don't know their music at all, and I hadn't heard of them.
Okay.
But then he didn't believe me when I said that. Like, I was like, I don't even know what you're talking about. They're not even Irish. And he was like, oh, nice try, ma'am. Nice try. Get to the back of the line. And I was like, no. And so it got kind of acrimonious, and I didn't want to be like, you know, fighting with a bouncer in the bloody village. But in the end, he let me in, you know. It's funny, I couldn't really be like, don't you know who I am? Nobody.
Higgins.
But anyway, will you let me in?
Maeve Higgins talking to John Murray on Thursday. Tom Vaughan Lawlor won an Irish Times Theatre Award for Best Actor this week for his role in Marco Rowe's Howie the Rookie. On Monday's Arena, the actor better known as Nidge in Love Hate told Sean Rocks about how the next season of the series is about to go into production.
We start in 3 weeks.
And how much do you know? I say loads. And how much are you telling me?
Well, I know little, and I can't tell you anything.
And you're telling me none of that little.
They're very kind of tight about, understandably, yeah, because the tabloids especially are kind of almost trying to always get one step ahead of what we do. So everything's kind of monitored. So everything's under wraps, very secretive.
I presume there's a great joy in being able to walk down the street where you are tonight in Peterborough and nobody knows who Nidge is.
Yeah, it's a very strange thing. You have bizarre moments where you meet Irish people who know the show, or indeed now English people who know the show, because it's the show, the first series here last year, and people who kind of, you know, recognise you. It's a very strange experience, but I'm very fortunate to have that experience as an actor.
Well, congratulations again on winning the award last night. Oh, one brief thing before you go. What happened to your shoes?
My shoes. I arrived in Dublin and realised I'd left my shoes at home, so I had to wear my Howie the Rookie shoes. So I had this amazing kind of suit that I got from a photo shoot, a very fancy photo shoot, but they were underscored or footnoted by my runners, so I had to apologise for those in my speech. I didn't want to be rude.
Tom Vaughan Lawlor talking to Sean Rocks on Monday's Arena. Last Sunday's drama on One Broken Promised Land told writer Mirjana Rendulic's own story of her experiences working as an exotic dancer.
Italian men adore athletes. Japanese men see pole dancing as an art form. Irish men are all about the chat.
Where are you from? Is that your real name?
Are all the girls as gorgeous in your country? Are those real? How much do you make in a night? I love learning strange pronunciations. Bus, Mooney, Pub. I love learning new expressions. Gaff, me ma, bleedin' this, bleedin' that. But soon I get tired of just chatting and going home with little cash. I've only made 200 euros in 2 nights. I become cheeky. My English, not so good, but I dance very, very nice. In the changing room, I listen to all sorts of conversations in so many different languages. Russian, Hungarian, Czech, Thai, Swedish. I enjoy listening to the Irish, English or Australian girls. I met Sarah in Guam just before she had a Thai surgery. No way! I used to share a bedsit with her best friend Anna, who was a hostess in Japan. Do you remember Lisa? She's now dancing in Iceland. She says she's pretending she's Eastern European. It helps her make more cash. I hear Irish girls pretending to be Russian too. Irish lads prefer us Eastern Europeans. They're so afraid that the Irish girls may know them in real life.
Actor and playwright Mirjana Rendulic has heard in last week's drama on One, Broken Promised Land, which was directed by Aoife Spillane-Hinks. That's about my lot for this week. To play us out, Reeve Carney was a guest on Arena on Monday. This is his rendition of Bohemian Rhapsody. I'm Fiona Kelly. So until next week, goodbye.
Mama just killed a man. Put a gun against his head. Pull my trigger, now he's dead. Mama, life had just begun, and now I've gone and thrown it all away. Mama. if nothing really matters. Too late, my time has come. Sent shivers down my spine. Body's aching all the time. Goodbye, everybody. I've got to go. I gotta leave you all behind and face the truth. Mama, nothing really matters.